All right, here we are. Lawyer Talk Off the Record, back on the air here with a guest this time, Mark Satawa. Mark is, we've been friends a long time, but what I'm trying to do here is introduce the people who listen to other practice or sort of interesting practice areas and talk to attorneys who handle those things. And there's a little bit of an overlap for me. I do criminal defense for those who check me out, Palmer Legal Defense. I do a ton of criminal defense. So does Mark. But Mark's got sort of a unique, I don't know if I'm allowed to call it a specialty in Michigan.
No, you can. Yeah.
Okay. In Ohio, you can't say specialty. But he's got a unique area of practice dealing with, well, I'm going to call it abusive head trauma because I'm not going to use the bad words just yet. But before we get there, Mark, just tell us a little bit about your practice, where you are, and then we'll jump on it.
I was a Wayne County prosecutor for several years, which is in Detroit, handling serious crimes, mainly homicides. I was there for 4 or 5 years and decided to go out on my own. I've been a criminal defense attorney ever since. And just like anything else, you kind of go into these unique areas of practice or specialties, as you can't call them in Ohio. And by accident, I mean, you sort of do a few cases, you're successful doing them, and you get some more successful doing those. And before you know it, you turn around and, you know, you're known as the
guy,
abusive head trauma guy.
Abusive head trauma, what's not bury the lead, as you like to say, what is the common parlance for abusive head trauma cases?
So abusive head trauma cases is what used to be called something else. And if you want to save that, we certainly can. But abusive head trauma is a form of child abuse that is prosecuted throughout the United States and throughout the world, where the idea is that someone takes a child and either with or without impact, and you can start going down into a deep dive into the weeds here, but they shake a child so violently and so aggressively that they tear bridging veins in the child's head, these veins that connect the surface of the brain and with the area inside the skull. These bridging veins tear. It causes a bleed below what's called the dura. The dura is this leathery membrane that protects the brain, that the brain sits in. It creates this blood between the dura and the brain called a subdural hematoma or a subdural hemorrhage. And this blood collects. The shaking will also tear the veins behind the retina, which will create what's called retinal hemorrhaging, which is bleeding in the eyes.
So eight ball hemorrhaging is what, like in the movies, that's what you would call it.
Subdural hematoma, retinal hemorrhaging, accompanied by some sort of neurologic crash or neurologic distress that's usually seen in the form of seizures or difficulty breathing, hypoxic, and that combination of symptoms with, and there are certainly other things that weave in and out of that. There are any number of additional symptoms, long bone fractures, other damage inside the actual brain, which is called intracranial injury, and any number of other, blood in the spine, tearing of the, you know, a ligamentous injury in either the neck or the spine. But the three most commonly associated injuries with abusive head trauma are a subdural hematoma or hemorrhage, which is again bleeding between the dura layer of the brain and the brain itself. A retinal hemorrhaging, which is bleeding behind the eyes, and some sort of neurologic crash that will lead parents to, the kid stops breathing, the kid is, eyes are rolling up in their head, the kid goes limp or really stiff, is having seizures. The parents will rush the child to the hospital. The hospital will start to treat the child. And sometimes if a CAT scan or an MRI is done and they see the subdural hematoma, that triggers sort of this red flag or the buzzer for, uh-oh, we think this child might be abused, and they'll start looking for those other symptoms, most notably retinal hemorrhages.
So everybody, I mean, look, let's just let the cat out of the bag. When I started practicing law, and until just recently, the term shaken baby syndrome is what you always heard with this, SBS.
Shaken baby syndrome is synonymous with abusive head trauma. The American Academy of Pediatrics several years ago sort of in order to combat the attacks put up by lawyers like you and I, defense lawyers and their experts, there's a real question that we can talk about later scientifically about whether shaking alone creates enough force measured by what are called radians per second squared, this radial, this acceleration force, whether human shaking alone can create enough force to cause a subdural hematoma. And so because it got so focused on the shaking word and shaken baby syndrome, they started moving away from it. They wanted to start saying like, well, regardless of whether it's shaking or shaking with impact or shaking with impact to a soft surface like a couch or a bed, they wanted to get away from the focus on shaking, so they came up with this term abusive head trauma to substitute for shaken baby syndrome. But as you said, a rose by any other name is still a rose, and this is the exact same diagnosis. Abusive head trauma is the exact same diagnosis as what used to be called shaken baby syndrome.
Well, I know what everybody's thinking out there. It's like, we're criminal defense lawyers. Our job is to go in and cast a bunch of shade on the prosecutor's case, see what sticks on the wall, make it confusing, try to pull a rabbit out of our hat or smoke screens and mirrors, make it look like our client didn't do it. I think there's a very real phenomenon here that we should talk about, and that is, in these types of cases, everybody starts with that thought. We're defending these cases. Your client's guilty, and you're just doing everything you can to make it confusing so he looks like he's not guilty. I mean, this is a good place to talk about recent successes you've had defending these cases and why that phenomena is.
So let's start with the basic premise that of all the crimes against children are the most abhorrent. I mean,
for good reason, right? Yeah, I mean, you're hurting kids. Who wants that?
Yeah. Well, and you know, look, they're our most vulnerable. We have to protect them. It's society's job to protect them. It is our job as a community to raise. The village needs to raise these children. Of course. I mean, and hell, they're victimized and targeted in prisons. The people that have abused children are ostracized and identified by other prisoners. So no one, there is no lobby marching to protect the rights of people charged with child abuse. So the crime of child abuse is one of the most abhorrent. The idea that you would hurt a child is unimaginable in the minds of most people. The cases we're talking about with abusive head trauma and shaken baby syndrome involve children younger than a year old and typically younger than 6 months old. I mean, you're talking about the most vulnerable, the youngest, the most helpless of us, these tiny, fragile, innocent lives that are completely and wholly dependent on their parents and their caregivers. And the idea, just the word shaken baby syndrome, and in a way, abusive head trauma even sounds worse, right? It even sounds like, you know, it. And so, but to be clear, in order to, and we'll talk about some of the studies later. In fact, famously, scientists tried to have Penn State football players back in the 80s shake anatomically correct dolls to try to create the amount of force necessary to cause a subdural hematoma. And the Penn State football team wasn't able to do it. But so there's some real controversy about whether or not you can shake a child with enough violence and force to create these injuries. But if it can happen, you're talking about something that is so beyond what any parent would do in the normal handling and care of an infant. It is quite literally like if you and I were seeing somebody doing it, we would think the person was trying to kill the child, you know. And so this common sort of stereotype of a parent or caregiver just getting overwhelmed with a child because they're crying too much or they're colicky and they won't go to sleep and they won't stop crying and they just get frustrated and in a moment of frustration they shake a child a little bit to sort of get them to stop crying. That's not enough.
So if I'm a caregiver and your kid, like your child is screaming, tantrum, colicky, whatever it would be, and you just say enough's enough and drop on the bed.
So that's sort of one of the real issues is this idea of short distance falls and impact. So there has been plenty of studies done. And of course, what is diagnosed as abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome is diagnosed and done by doctors, what are commonly called child abuse pediatricians. And there's about 350 of them in the United States. And it is a recognized specialty, a subspecialty of pediatrics. They get board certified to basically diagnose child abuse. And of course, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a...
Everything looks like a nail, you know, right.
So yeah. If you're going to look for child abuse, you're going to find child abuse. And then, so that's the first problem. But the second problem is that doctors are notoriously bad at determining the mechanism of injury, right? That's why forensic pathologists go to a special program that basically trains them to look for signs of injury, mechanisms of injury, the results of injury. When was the last time you went into a doctor with a broken arm and that doctor asked you how'd you break your arm and argued with you if you told them a history that they thought might not be incorrect? It doesn't matter whether you fell out of a tree or you were in a car accident or you were riding your bike or you fell down the stairs.
Or even like a shooting, right? Like how many homicide cases where there's a bullet wound that caused a death? Like the doctor doesn't get on the witness stand and say, well, the shooter must have been standing over there at this angle with this trajectory or whatever it is. I mean, there are specialties that do that, and it's not the treating physician.
So what happens is, exactly. So what happens is these child abuse pediatricians, they're trained to doctors are trained to treat sick people. Pediatricians are trained to treat sick kids. They're not trained to determine how a child got hurt. And no matter what child abuse pediatricians say, that is not their specialty. There is a specialty that does that. They're called biomechanical engineers, and they get paid. They go to school for a gazillion years to get PhDs, and they get trained for decades, and they get grants from the federal government to do all kinds of things, including most famously study car crashes. How do we make cars safer? How do we make infants safer? Rear-facing car seats and for children and all that. These are all the result of studies and experiments performed by biomechanical engineers. And biomechanical engineers have studied this phenomenon. And regardless of where you weigh in on whether shaking alone can cause a subdural hematoma and retinal hemorrhaging, what is unquestioned is that biomechanical engineers have been able to establish with very little debate short distance falls from as little as 2 feet or less create as much or more force than violently shaking an infant. And the reason for that is fairly obvious, right? Gravity is a really strong force. It's why we don't go floating off the planet. And there have been videotaped eyewitness incidents of children falling as little as 18 to 24 inches and hitting their head and causing a subdural hematoma. So
hitting the head on a hard object.
Well, yes.
Or is a bed enough?
Well, so that's again another area of debate that will go on because where the soft impact comes from, the idea of a child hitting its head on a couch or a pillow or a bed. The rationale by the child abuse pediatricians talks about that this acceleration deceleration. So it's this idea that the head is on this fulcrum and it goes forward and the head stops violently. The brain continues going forward and smacks into the front of the head. And then it reverses course and goes backward. And now the skull is moving backward. The brain goes behind it. And then when the skull stops again, the brain slams into the back of the brain and that gets repeated. And that's what sort of causes this sort of shearing, acceleration, deceleration injury. The problem with that, to the point you just made, is this idea that so Is shaking with a sudden stop onto a soft surface potentially more dangerous than shaking alone? Sure, because you're adding this, like, all of a sudden stop, which is not just stop because you stop shaking the child, but the child's head actually hit an object, and that object wasn't hard enough to cause a skull fracture or damage to the exterior of the child's scalp, but maybe enough to have caused a deceleration, a sudden stop of the acceleration. So that's the rationale behind that and the reasoning behind it. And again, the problem is that falling, the short distance fall, creates just as much acceleration as the shaking does, and probably more. The biomechanical engineers would tell us more. Is it more likely that shaking with impact, even onto a soft surface, would cause these injuries? Yes, but is shaking onto a soft surface more likely to cause the injuries than a fall or a fall to a soft surface? No, it's not.
Well, I'm going to go back to something you said and talk about, you and I have worked on these cases together. So some of this I know, but I think I'm learning too as I'm listening to you. You referenced a study by the Penn State football team where I presume what happened is some really strong big dudes were recruited to say, here, shake this doll that's as close as we can make it to a human baby and try to duplicate the injuries that the abuse docs would say are caused by shaken baby syndrome. And they couldn't do it.
By a factor of five. So they created about 20% of the necessary acceleration force.
And what's interesting to me in all the cases I've worked on, and believe me, I've worked on cases sometimes where there has been abuse by the accused that is evident irrespective of abusive head trauma. In other words, there's clear injuries of a beating or something. Let's leave that out of it for a second. How about one of the cases we worked on, for instance, down in Arkansas, there was this alleged type of shaking. What do the biomechanical engineers say about a Penn State linebacker from Linebacker U shaking an infant with the head going back and forth? How does that not break the baby's neck or at least sever something in the baby's neck or cause fractures?
So you've identified the second issue, and it's almost impossible to explain away. But before we get to that, in fairness, what the child abuse pediatricians would point out about these studies is that no one shook human infants to try to see if they could produce what force was necessary to produce a subdural hematoma, right, or retinal hemorrhage.
Inherently flawed by a dummy instead of a real baby.
Right. So what happened is that they took a study done by a doctor where he was studying the centrifugal force on brains, and they were using rhesus monkeys. Okay. So the data they have is on monkeys, monkey-sized heads, monkey-sized brains, monkey-sized skulls. They have extrapolated that through math and biomechanics to say, okay, if this is the amount of force needed to cause a subdural hematoma on a monkey, this is much what we would expect scientifically to be necessary to produce in an infant. There's criticism about the math. There's criticism about the analysis that leads us from monkeys to young infants. The second problem you pointed out very directly is that anatomically correct 3-month-old or 6-month-old dummies are not 3-month-old children or 6-month-old children. So yes, that is an area that can be criticized. And again, we could do a deep dive into every one of these topics. I'm just going to table both of those two things for a minute here. But the bottom line is that, and this is one of those areas where, you know, we're going to talk later about how you win these cases, because they can be defended, and they can be defended successfully, and they can be won. And one of the things is you really, really want to get your judge and then your jury to understand that they shouldn't check their common sense at the door when analyzing these cases. Because what child abuse pediatricians really ask us to do is, I know it when I see it. I'm a doctor. I have a gazillion years of education and training. I'm telling you this is abuse. You need to trust me. And
even if your eyes deceive you, even if your ears deceive you, even if it none of this makes any sense in any other part of you, the physics world that you live in, believe me, I know.
And the common sense analysis that you talked about a minute ago is, okay, doc, then how is it that this baby's neck is completely intact? How is it that you didn't break this child's neck before you caused a subdural hematoma? And I will tell you, biomechanical engineers will tell you that it is likely impossible. Now, of course, we're talking scientists, so they never say anything is impossible. But you ask a question that has not been adequately answered by the child abuse pediatric community. Because again, it just makes sense, right? If you're going to shake a three-month-old infant, what's the first thing you did, Steve, when you held your son for the first time? Support his head.
Cradle the head, right? Because it's on a swivel. I mean, it can't hold it. Even you hand grandma the baby, like grandmas and moms, they know.
Forever. It's like they automatically snap right back into mode.
They
right?
know. Yeah. And they immediately, like they know. But you see somebody else grab the, or not grab the baby, but you hand the baby to somebody else who doesn't know that. And it's always remarkable to me, a couple of things have been remarkable about defending these cases and my experience raising kids. It's going to sound horrible, but how resilient they really are, you know, on some level. You know, it's like you see the baby's head do that, and then it's fine. Grandma's got the hand on it. But the point is the head does this very quickly without any support. And I can't imagine if I wanted to break the kid's neck, I think I could do it very easily by just shaking the crap out of it and even snap the head off. That's how it feels.
So your instincts are always good. I've worked with you for years and, you know, obviously I have a ton of respect for you and both your intellect, but also your common sense. So once again, you're doing what Steve does, which is sort of drill to the heart of a question and an issue. And what you're really asking is this. I think we as parents all go through this thing where these babies, and when they're infants, before they're, say, 3 or 4 years old, they're so fragile, they're so vulnerable, that we put ourselves in this almost like denial, right? Like we almost deny that anything could happen to them because we are just one slip away on the changing table or on the rocking chair, rocking your child, burping your child. You know, you're carrying your child and you're checking your pot of coffee. You know, how many times have you answered the phone while holding your child in one hand? And we're all one dumb thing away from a child falling from a height of 4 or 5 feet as you're holding it to a tiled hardwood floor and causing catastrophic neurologic injury to that child. So we kind of live in this, we almost kind of develop this idea that it could never happen to me. So then when confronted with injuries like this, when these people come in to serve as jurors in a case, I really think that they are insulated in their own head, like that this didn't ever happen to me because it could never happen. Because you truly have convinced yourself, raising your children the way you just described it, that it could never happen to you because you never want to believe that your child lived the first 2 or 3 years of his life this far.
Yeah, in grave danger.
Is there any other kind? Right.
So, well, this is a good transition point because you've had recent successes up in Michigan and I think a string of like 4 cases. So what I want you to do is sort of maybe take a standard fact pattern. Like how does somebody get from the situation you're talking about? So maybe this. And I survived something like this with one of my kids who took what I call a header out of his crib at a very young age. He got up there and, you know, fell out of his crib and we had hardwood floors and we freaked out his parents and we took him to the hospital. They x-rayed and all the stuff that they do. And, you know, Lord, it was fine. You know, he's fine. Here he is. He's a 21-year-old man now. But we freaked out and it's never, and even at that experience, I remember sitting at the hospital thinking, having done this for a few years at that point, all right, how many times am I going to have to tell this story? And how much scrutiny am I going to get for this story? Because they are going to think that I abused my child. And they did. You know, 4 or 5 times, like I had to go, somebody new come in, the nurse came in, the guy came in. And I'm sure, I didn't know all the hierarchy, but How does it go from how does somebody normal end up in your office?
Well, I mean, you sort of started us down that road. You're educated. You have not just a college degree, but a post-college degree. You're in the upper 10% of educated people in this country. You're smart. You're middle class, upper middle class. You're not a person of color. You're not poor. You're not uneducated, and you're not a person of color who don't have any of the advantages that you're talking about. So imagine that person coming in and being asked first by the triage nurse and then the ER doc, and then they do a CT scan, and then you have someone else come in and they have the hospital social worker come in, and then you have the child abuse pediatrician come in, and then you have a representative from Child Protective Services come in, and then the police come in. That's what, 5 or 6 interviews we've just discussed.
And by the way, I got through 4 of those.
Yeah.
The only thing that didn't happen to me is the police didn't come in.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, I mean, by the way, as you're being interviewed, depending on the condition, physical medical condition of your child is in the hospital. So they're in some medical distress. And frequently, they're fighting for their lives, and you're being asked what happened. Yeah. And so
what possibly else could I be thinking of other than trying to convince this doctor one thing or another?
And what are they all telling you? You have to tell us what happened, because if you don't, they can't treat your son or your daughter. They can't save your son. They can't save your daughter. So if you're holding back information, you are putting your child in danger, grave danger, as you said before.
Right, of course.
So, you know, and so it's a very, very difficult situation. And here's the problem. Once the CT or MRI sees a subdural hematoma and the ophthalmologist is called in and the ophthalmologist sees retinal hemorrhaging, child abuse pediatricians are trained, no matter what they say, that is diagnostic of abuse. So it doesn't matter what Steve says at that point. No story short of we were in a car accident going at least 50 miles an hour, or the child fell out of a 5-story window because they don't believe in the idea of short distance falls, which we can talk about later. They don't believe in the idea of a lucid interval, which we can talk about later. They don't believe in the idea of a chronic subdural rebleeding, which we can talk about later. What they believe is that the subdural and the retinal hemorrhaging are diagnostic of abuse, and nothing you say is going to get them off that. You're a witch. Prove you're not.
And I want to make something clear about what you said. You used 2 metaphorical analogies, a 60-mile-an-hour crash. How fast?
You know, it will vary, but it's typically somewhere around 50 miles an hour.
50 miles an hour or a 5-story fall. You use both those analogies. You didn't make that up to make the point here in the show.
No.
You and I have both heard doctors on witness stands saying that this is what it, if it's not this, or if it's not this abusive head trauma and child abuse, then it would have to be these other things.
It would be a history consistent with a 50-mile-an-hour car crash or falling out of a 5-story window. Yes. Yeah. That's, again, not me made up. That is direct quotation of child abuse pediatricians that I've dealt with, that you've dealt with, that we've dealt with. Correct.
And, you know, take my example, just since we've sort of set us down this path anyway. Let's say I don't make it, or it comes through, and at some point during the diagnostics of my son, he's got these 2 symptoms. And next thing I know, I got the police there. I'm just sitting there thinking, look, I was just in the other room. I heard a big crash. I came in, and this is what it is. And already they being the doctors, have concluded, not only am I lying, I've committed a crime of child abuse.
Well, and see, it's really even more insidious than that, right? Because not only are they going to accuse, so there are 2 parts to the prosecution in proving someone is guilty of a crime, right? First, they have to prove a crime occurred. So in this instance, we're talking about they have to be able to prove the existence of abuse. They have to prove the idea that Steve's infant is sick like this, injured like this because of abusive head trauma. Then they have to prove who did it. So then they engage in a second set of theoretical supposition on an inference. And so it's not only are they ascribing the act, they're saying it had to be trauma. It had to have been forceful trauma.
Not a fall from a crib.
They are then ascribing intent, right? Because it's not.
You're not going to accidentally do that, right?
It's not accidental head trauma or you know, what it's abusive head trauma. And of course, the word abuse has intent, an intent element in it. And then they take the next step. So they, as if those first two steps weren't enough, they take the next step. And that next step is to say, and it had to have happened within minutes of the child presenting to the ER. And by doing that, they are trying to eliminate other suspects other than the person who had care and custody of the child in the immediate several minutes at the most before the child presented to the ER.
And I've got no answer to that sitting at Children's Hospital while these people are sort of descended on me, telling me this.
Yeah.
And you're at the, all the while I'm wondering, I wonder how my son's doing. I wonder how my son, why are the cops here now? What's going on? We've worked on enough of these cases where people have boxed themselves or been boxed in before they even know it happened.
So
it's the Roach Motel.
Well, and we're talking about your personal experience. So of course your son ended up being fine, but what if he wasn't? God forbid if he had a subdural hematoma and he had retinal hemorrhaging and he had neurologic distress. They were telling you, right? He is having seizures. His brain didn't get enough oxygen. He's fighting for his life. What happened? You know, you're going to start thinking like, well, like I will tell you, the clients I've represented have told the police, they've told the social worker at the hospital, they've told CPS, Child Protective Services, they've told nurses and doctors and child abuse pediatricians. You know, I was feeding him and, you know, he fell off the couch onto his little burpee pillow, or, there was this time that I took him out of his car seat and I tripped and I dropped the car seat and the car seat fell a foot. You know, you start trying to manufacture, not manufacture, but you're trying to create these hypothetical scenarios that would explain to help them treat your child. Like, you know,
it's interesting you brought it up this way because it put me right back there 15 or however long that was ago. And it got me thinking. I wasn't in the room. I heard a loud crash and I heard, you know, a thump. And when I was asked what happened, what they were really asking me to do is guess and speculate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
And
yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, I'm trying to help them diagnose because, well, it's like, look, doc, we got hardwood floors. Right next to the crib is the changing table, and that's got a hard thing. So maybe, you know, he probably jumped out of this and maybe hit his head there and maybe hit the floor or maybe did this. And none of that really came up in my case, but you can easily see how somebody, even as I was open, as I was sort of in tune for this, could get trapped into doing what we always talk about in any criminal case. One of the cardinal reasons you don't talk to the police is because eventually they get you into a place where they want you to speculate about why something happened. And pretty soon the speculation sounds like you're telling them what happened. And pretty soon you're incriminating yourself.
Well, and
except this is to a doctor. Sorry to cut you off.
No.
Even worse.
Well, and you know, look, you nailed it when you said like you have those advantages, right? You were educated. You were a lawyer. You were a criminal defense lawyer, and you still sort of saw yourself going down that road before, to use your words, you caught yourself going, well, you know, like, no. I was in the other room. I heard a crash. That's all I know.
Yeah, the reality is I don't know what happened.
Right.
But if you want to know what the room looked like, here's what it is.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so, you know, you a few minutes ago, you asked about like sort of like some successes I've had. And I'll tell you that the one thing in common that the case you talked about in Arkansas and I did a case in Oakland County.
In Michigan.
In Michigan, just outside Detroit. I did a case in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And the thing that all three of these cases had in common is a fact pattern where, and it is eerie, it's scary how similar these fact patterns were. In all three cases, we had an event where the parents took the infant to the hospital for some reason. In all three cases, although they were a little bit different, the basic complaint was, my child is neurologically distressed. They're having seizures. Well, what do you mean they're having seizures? Well, he went stiff, and then he went limp, and then his eyes fluttered, or they rolled up into the back of his head. He was having difficulty breathing. He was really labored breathing. In one of the cases, the case in Oakland County, the child's mother was an ER nurse. In the case in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they lived less than a five-minute walk from the ER they took the child to. So, I mean, they got immediate medical attention. And in all three cases, someone other than the person ultimately charged had care and custody of the child during that first presentation to the hospital. They do testing. In one of the cases, they actually did an ultrasound. In another case, they actually did a CT. And in another case, they didn't do any radiology at all. They discharged the child. In all three cases, the child was discharged with what's called a BRUE, B-R-U-E, brief, resolved, unexplained event. Now, look, we as criminal defense lawyers could have a field day with that. I mean,
what could go wrong with that diagnosis, right? It's like, oh, it's UFO season right now, too. Right. So.
In all seriousness, this idea that doc, you know, like, I always tell clients, like when I'm getting a client ready for a trial and they say, oh, well, the jury's going to be discharged and told what a reasonable doubt is. I always say, yeah, you know what they're going to be told? A reasonable doubt is a doubt based on reason. And I always tell them, only lawyers could come up with a definition of reasonable doubt is a reasonable doubt, right? Right. It's a doubt based on reason. Only doctors would come up with a diagnosis called brief, resolved, unexplained event. I was talking to a neurologist once recently, and he was talking about SIDS.
Infant death syndrome.
And yeah. He said, you know what SIDS is? It's us saying we don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a big I don't know.
Yeah. And he's like, but you know what? It makes the parents who are going through this unspeakable grief feel better because we give it a diagnosis, right? We don't know what happened to this poor child. We just know the child died all of a sudden. Sometimes stuff happens, right? Well, that's what a BRUE is. They quite literally say, well, you know, children are, you know, when they're young, sometimes their wiring gets a little screwy and you know, they obviously there was some neurologic thing going on because in all three of those cases, there was some collaborative evidence that the child was in some distress. I mean, in two of the three cases, the child's breathing was low. In all three cases, the oxidization in the blood was below what it should have been. Two of the three kids were hypoxic. One of the kids showed seizure activity once when they were actually in the hospital. So, I mean, there were these parents weren't making this up. There was verifiable signs as to why the parents brought these three children into the hospital. And they were all sent home. In the one case, it was a matter of 6 days. In another case, it was the matter of 2 weeks. And in the third case, it was 3 days. So it was a week. It was 2 weeks, a week, and 2 days, two or three days. And the child really crashes. This time, and in all three cases, Steve, all three cases, child has the identical symptoms as the first presentation to the hospital. Going back the second time, yeah. The parents take the child back to the ER.
Another BRUE.
And they say, child went limp. Child went stiff. Child had difficulty breathing. Whatever, right? We couldn't revive them. They wouldn't respond. They wouldn't even respond if we were poking them or her. Now the child is looked at a second time. Of course, the doctors and everyone know that the child was just here 2 days ago, 6 days ago, 2 weeks ago. So now they give the child more radiology and they find a subdural hematoma. In all cases, the subdural in all three cases cannot be dated because, quite frankly, it's very difficult to date these with any kind of accuracy.
Meaning they couldn't tell when it happened.
They could not tell how old the subdural was.
Yeah.
Okay. But in all three cases, the subdural could have been as old as the previous hospitalization. But that didn't stop them from seeing retinal hemorrhaging, combining that with the subdural, combining that with the now worse neurologic arrest or defect. Of course, one could say, well, maybe the neurologic arrest or problem this time was worse because it went untreated for the last 2 or 3 days, the last 6 days, the last 14 days. But, you know, now the child has been diagnosed as being abused, and in each one of those three cases, not coincidentally, the father was had care and custody of the child in the second presentation, and the child is now said to be have been abused. And it doesn't matter that we can't say for sure when the trauma occurred, because a child abuse pediatrician will solve that problem for us. The child abuse pediatrician will say the neurologic deficit, the neurologic crash, is so significant that a child, that a parent would have noticed it immediately. It would have been immediately noticeable to any caregiver. They would have immediately brought the child into the hospital. These injuries are less than an hour old from presentation to hospital. So now we can eliminate any suspect, any other suspect than the suspect that was had the care and custody of the child in the immediate, when 911 was called, when the child was rushed to the ER.
All right. So we got these two incidents, say one on Monday, one on Friday. The doctors somehow rationalize away through medicine any relevance of the Monday, because the symptoms on Friday, there could not have been that lucid interval in between. It had to happen within hours or even minutes at times of what they're seeing now, meaning whoever had the baby back here couldn't be guilty.
Well, and it's so, again, I mean, if they can't do that, not only do you have the problem of the time between the second presentation and the first presentation, but you have the problem of the time who was taking care of the child in the first presentation. And you have the history of the baby's life, right? I mean, and so they have to somehow, some way, if they can't establish a timeline for when the injuries occurred, then they can't identify a perpetrator. And they can diagnose the abuse of head trauma, they can diagnose the crime, but they can't diagnose the perpetrator. It doesn't do them, meaning police and prosecutors, that much good. So they buy into this fallacy perpetrated by the child abuse pediatric community that these injuries can be timed with any kind of accuracy. And they just can't.
And the case we worked on, I think, in Arkansas, the earlier injury, there's a couple possibilities, but one was a pretty hard fall from a countertop.
As well as something hitting the child at daycare.
That took him in. And then just a week later, at some interval later, I can't remember exactly what, that was completely swept away from the case, completely, as an irrelevant coincidence.
So what they're battling is the medical problem that's called a chronic subdural hematoma. So when doctors use the words acute, subacute, chronic, it means kind of what the doctor wants it to mean at any time. And there's no like hard and fast definition. Acute means less than 24 to 48 hours. It means really recent, but it doesn't mean like some specific time period. Chronic means longer than that. So You know, and so when you look at radiology, so here's the first of many elephants in the room that we're going to talk about scientifically, Steve, and that is this. With all due respect to any radiologists out there, you and I love that scene in Spies Like Us. Are there any Paraguayans here? No?
Right, okay. Right.
Are there any radiologists here? You know, right, exactly. With all due respect to any radiologists out there, radiology is one of the most subjective fields of medicine.
Yeah, you see a little shadow right there? You see a little smudge?
Look, the film is the film, of course. I mean, the MRI is the MRI, the CT is the CT, but what we interpret that as being is all human subjectivity. So when something bleeds initially, in order to break that blood down, the body is engaging in its usual healing process. So fresh blood is going to be a certain color. And as it ages, it gets gray. And then as it gets old, it gets a lot darker. So when you see white, gray, and dark, what we know, or at least used to know, is that means that this injury has different stages. There's an acute part of it, there's a healing part of it, and there's a chronic part of it. There's a part that's been here for a while. I mean, it wouldn't look like that if we didn't look that way. I actually, in the one case, the 6-day case, I had the head of neurology at a teaching hospital. The head of neurosurgery at a teaching children's hospital say that this is what's called acute on chronic, which means this is both a fresh injury and an old injury combined. The child abuse pediatrician in that university said that the person who went through what, 10 years of specialized training and fellowships to get to the point where he could operate on the brain of a 4-month-old is wrong. What that is a combination of fresh blood, because we have to say it's fresh, or the person who had the child at the time of the presentation to the ER isn't the perpetrator.
The person you want to be guilty might not be guilty.
Right. Combined with something else. And the most common something else is spinal fluid. And they've created this relatively new term called a heptahygroma, which means blood mixed with spinal fluid. So it's no longer...
Sort of in the brainstem area.
But it's not in the brainstem area. It's in the subdural space.
Oh, okay.
Which is a problem.
Right. I ask such an obvious question?
You inadvertently stumbled on a problem. Right. But what used to be mixed density, meaning this mix, was evidence that an injury was both fresh and old, is now a heptahygroma. So instead of being a mix of old and new injury, it's now a new injury combined with something else. So again, there's no limit to which they will sort of, you know, it's kind of like playing a crooked card game where even if you win the crooked card game, the dealer says, well, you know what, I'm going to change the rules at the end. Even though you think you won, I just said you lost. It's really what's...
Yeah, it's a shell game.
Yeah. And so this diagnosis of, and again, they used to deal with the mixed density question by just saying the obvious, right? What would you say if you were a child abuse pediatrician? Well, it just shows this child's been abused before. I mean, abuse is typically a pattern, right? It gets repeated. So of course this child has old blood. The kid was shaken before. And this is not the first time the child's been abused. But what happened is how do they prove that it was the same person who shook the child the first time?
Right. They've still got those three things, right? Yeah. They have to have the crime, they have to have the intent, and then they have to have the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the problem. Well, let's shift gears for a second. And at first I was going to sort of talk to you about, all right, well, as a lawyer, what should we do? And then talk about maybe as somebody who's facing an accusation, sort of like I was, what should I do? But I think really it's both. So if I go to you in my scenario that I brought up, and lo and behold, the police are there, and the worst thing possibly could have happened to me is that my child died, and now the police are there. In a perfect world, what do I do? Who do I call? You, obviously. But who do I call?
Not Ghostbusters,
and,
right?
And not go, but who? Yeah. How do I know I'm in the right place? What, like, play it out. What's the perfect scenario and what's the common scenario?
So like any other criminal case, and I think you and I have discussed this both on air and privately in cases we've done together, the successful building of a defense involves a theme and theory. Like, what do we say happened? Okay. And you gotta start with sort of, all right, what is our answer to the idea that this child was abused? And again, that's got to incorporate everything. Because as I said before, I mean, we're not left with, in most of these cases, simply a subdural hematoma, retinal hemorrhaging, and some neurologic crash. We will frequently have corroborating evidence. So in the case in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, as an example, the child had what's called a metaphyseal corner lesion, which, to make it sound a lot more serious, has now been changed by a lot of child abuse pediatricians to a metaphyseal corner fracture. And that's what sometimes is called a bucket handle fracture. And it's this tiny little chip on the knee area of an infant. And they claim it's diagnostic of abuse. And so they'll do a body survey. They'll do a full body scan, which is basically an X-ray of the entire body from multiple views. And they'll see, are there any long bone injuries? Oh, look, there's a metaphyseal corner lesion or fracture if you're a child abuse pediatrician. Ha! Now we know the child was abused because the child's leg was twisted. That's the only way this kind of injury could be happened is you take the child and you twist it, and that's what causes this bucket handle fracture. In this case, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the radiologist, and again, it's classic, right? Because you can probably recite the radiology report without even having ever seen the radiology report in this case, but it reads, consistent with a suspected corner metaphyseal fracture. Okay, so it's not necessarily a corner metaphyseal fracture. It's consistent with a suspected corner metaphyseal fracture. And then the next line in the radiology report, follow-up radiology recommended in 2 weeks. Now, what is the obvious question you ask yourself as a layperson who isn't a radiologist? Why do they want the follow-up radiology in 2 weeks?
They want to find more injuries. They want to find out.
They want to confirm the injury.
Yeah, they're building a case at this point.
If the injury is still there, that is significant. I mean, that would be like, oh, look, now we see healing. There's calcification going on here. You know, you can see bones heal in a very, very patterned, expected, predictable way. We see this healing going on. You know, so we have this reaction that doctors look for in the healing. In this case, they came back 2 weeks later, and the corner metaphyseal fracture was gone. There was no healing. There was no reaction. There was no calcification. Nothing that you would expect there to be was there. Okay? So they just said, oh, well, it healed. It resolved. The fact of the matter is that, again, this is where they ask you to check your common sense at the door. It
resolved without any artifact whatsoever that would almost always be there if your bone heals.
And doctors that don't get caught up in this child abuse pediatric complex, to sort of paraphrase or steal General Eisenhower's famous quote, they would tell you that outside the context of a prosecution for child abuse, they would say, of course, a corner metaphyseal fracture doesn't just resolve without any evidence of it 2 weeks later.
So maybe there was a mistaken diagnosis. Maybe they saw an artifact in the image. Maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't there at all.
Maybe the corner metaphyseal lesion or fracture was never even there. All right. But that's not what happens. And so what happens in that case is our theme in theory now has to account for a first hospitalization, a hospitalization 3 days later for the same symptoms. It has to account for the radiology at the first hospitalization and the second hospitalization. It has to account for the corner metaphyseal lesion. It has to account for the subdural hematoma, the retinal hemorrhaging, the neurologic distress, the crash this child suffered when it came in, the Upper Peninsula was a she. When she came in the second time, the infant was a she, was a daughter. And so you can't, again, like any theme or theory, you can't pick or choose what facts help you and ignore the ones that hurt you. You got to incorporate all of it. You got to say, look, as BS as that magically resolved corner metaphyseal fracture may sound, we have to account for it in our explanation of what happened. And then you have this idea that, you know, doctors would never lie about something like this. They would never make up an accusation of child abuse. I mean, these are doctors. What's the first?
Yeah, first do no harm.
Correct.
Right.
And so, you know, so now we have, okay, we have a diagnosis by a doctor. The doctor says this child's been abused. We have all these facts. So what happens is the easiest, when you and I started doing criminal defense, when we worked for other lawyers, as we started grinding our,
paving our way
and laying our road, what was beaten into our head? Our client's presumed innocent. The burden of proof is on the prosecutor, and the burden of proof is a high one. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is not a theme in theory in most child abuse cases.
And what you're really saying is it's not a viable one. It's nothing you want to walk into a courtroom only with that. You need an explanation.
Now, it's an important tool to use, because when you can't answer the question of, like, well, why would that radiologist say that the corner metaphyseal lesion just magically resolved 2 weeks later without any evidence that it was ever there, you can point to the fact that, look, the judge says you, the jury, get to determine whether or not some doubt is a reasonable doubt that an acquittal can and should be based on. But if there is a question about a fact, if there is a question about an important part of this case, an important facet or issue in this case, there is only one side that has a burden. And as a defense attorney and as a defense team, I think you can effectively use the burden of proof in that instance to say, look, they're saying this magic metaphyseal fracture somehow resolved itself without any healing 2 weeks later. And you heard our experts say that just doesn't happen. If there's a question in your mind as to whether that's true or not, the prosecutor is the only side that has a burden here. So I think that's a way you can effectively use those important concepts. But as a starting point, you have to build a defense case. And by that, I mean a proactive defense case that starts with a timeline. It starts with lay witnesses that can talk about the parenting of your client and how many different people saw your client parent the child, and it's pulled together by experts. And you and I have done this both at the trial level and the appellate level, and we've seen it done right and we've seen it done wrong, and we've represented clients on appeal and post-conviction matters when experts weren't used. So let's be very, very clear about something before we go talk about each one of those individual necessary components to a defense. The timeline, the witnesses, the experts cannot you cannot effectively defend a shaken baby abusive head trauma case without the assistance of experts. You cannot do it. I know as much about the medicine and the science as any lawyer in the country, save a few geniuses like Barry Scheck and Keith Finley. Okay.
And me.
And you, yeah, of course. Right, right, right. But I'm not a doctor. And I did not stay in a Holiday Inn Express the night before a trial. So there is no way I'm going to win a battle on a witness stand with a doctor without the assistance of doctors and biomechanics to help me do that.
By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.